Welcome everyone again to our second series of agriculture webinars where we're trying to hear from people that are actually working at some point in the agricultural sector. And I want to issue an incredible welcome to Chris Clayton, and thank you, Chris, very much for joining us. By way of introduction, Chris Clayton is the agricultural policy editor of DTN Progressive Farmer, where he's been writing and editing since 2005. After working more than 7 years as a reporter for the Omaha World Herald. So he's been recognized as a Writer of the Year by the American Agricultural Editors Association, and he has won Story of the Year several times from that organization. He's also won the Glenn Cunningham Agricultural Journalist of the Year Award from the North American Agricultural Journalists, and he's also been the president of that group for 2012 and 13. And both the National Farmers Union and the American Coalition of Ethanol have each named him Communicator of the Year, and I can, having spoken with him, I can attest to that. He's a great communicator. And so what I'd like to do is first, he is the author also of an e-book that goes by the name of The Elephant in the Cornfield, The Politics of Agriculture and Climate Change. And he describes this book as his 8-year journal reporting on federal policy, conservation, food production, politics, and climate change, which began in 2009. Many of you might remember that's when the debate over the Waxman-Markey cap and trade bill was going on in Congress. He decided to write a book at the 2011 American Farm Bureau Federation annual meeting, where it became clear that the American Farm Bureau Federation had become opposed to any kind of policy that reduced greenhouse gas emissions, and even opposed to policies that they had previously been in favor of, having to do with incentivizing carbon sequestration, which was something that the agricultural sector could contribute to solving climate change. So in the book, and this is what I'd like to just kind of start off by asking him a few questions about, he explains how this strange state of affairs took shape. And in his book, he goes through this. And in my view, he really just kind of lays out and explains a lot of the challenges that I think we as CCLers are having in trying to build mutually respectful and productive relationships with those that are in agriculture. And so what I'd like to do is, I'd like to start off by just asking Chris a few questions. So I think when we talked before, I had gone over and explained to you what, you know, or just kind of reminded you what CCL was all about, and what we were trying to do in terms of better understand and better communicate with and build relationships with farmers. And we realized we really needed to talk to people who understood farmers. So I think that's pretty clear, and that our focus was putting an economy-wide price on carbon, and that we were trying to explore ways that other solutions that might work for agriculture, and also understand really what the barriers were to even talking about that with farmers. So maybe I could just start out by asking you, if you could just say briefly, what exactly is the elephant in the cornfield?
Well, it was just basically, you know, the play on words was really, by the time I had written the book, we agricultural policy and most of the discussion, the words climate change had just basically become taboo. Nobody's talking about climate change so much in DC in policy circles as much anymore. We haven't had a hearing specifically on issues related to climate change with the House or Senate Agriculture Committees, for instance, since December 2009. So am I still on? I don't know, I got a funky screen.
Yes,
here.
You are.
Anyway, okay. So that was kind of the play on words there when I was looking for a title. I just felt like it was like the elephant in the room, so to speak. You know, we're ignoring the elephant in the room when it comes to carbon issues and whether it is sequestration or building organic matter in the soil or just the risks of climate resiliency on our crops, livestock, and food systems. You know, climate change is kind of the elephant in the room. So I called it the elephant in the cornfield. So that was really the play on those words. And I've lost Jan's speaker.
So why do you, this is Jan again. So why do you think that's the case? I mean, in the book, you kind of go through a series of, you know, events which kind of make the point you just made, that people just kind of dance around the issue or don't talk about the issue. Or...
Well, there were a couple of things. One was the Citizens United case, and really the opening and ending of unleashed corporate campaign contributions, and really leading up to, I think Citizens United was in 2008, leading up to that, 2007 and before, you had a lot of bipartisan efforts.
Mm-hmm.
A lot more, you know, you had the early discussions of Warner-Lieberman bill, which was kind of the one of the first big iterations of having a carbon, a price on carbon. You had, going back further, 2001, 2002, a lot of discussion, even in the Farm Bill discussion at that time, in the Senate particularly, about having a carbon offset program for agriculture. So you had a lot more bipartisan efforts. And then really after Citizens United happened, and then, of course, President Obama being elected, all bipartisanship on the effort, on the issue of climate change pretty much stopped. I don't think maybe Henry Waxman helped out a lot in his efforts to ram a bill through the House the way he did. And his moves, but by the time you were in 2009, you know, there was really no bipartisanship on the issue, and agriculture after agriculture had had a working group in DC working on carbon issues for quite some time. You know, they were kind of anticipating, okay, if there's a big national bill on climate change, what does agriculture want in it? And after President Obama was elected, the American Farm Bureau Federation walked away from those efforts, particularly. The group actually got pretty much everything that it had wanted in the Waxman-Markey bill. Now, ag was a late player in the Waxman-Markey bill, but when the bill was finally put forward in the House, ag pretty much got what it wanted, a huge offset program, a lot of funding programs for to encourage production like no-till and reducing fertilizer usage. And so there were a lot of conservation efforts. And the way I viewed it was, you know, you're finally going to get a market incentive for conservation practices on the farm. That was really what was in the Waxman-Markey bill for agriculture, was conservation incentives funded through private markets. And, you know, the notion among conservatives, particularly, that, you know, they were not going to work with President Obama and his team or work with Democrats on anything in the first 2 years of his presidency, you know, really try to ice out his initiatives. Climate change was certainly one of those. So you had these partisan dynamics and politics going on. You know, we're not going to work with Obama on anything. They started that really from the get-go. So climate change became one of the most partisan issues out there. You know, and in the Midwest and then the South, you literally had coal interests going around holding rallies, you know, to defend energy as we know it. And they, of course, got lots of workers from power plants and others to show up with those things. But ag kind of got swept up in the partisanship of it all. Mm-hmm. And Farm Bureau, particularly, I think of most of the general and commodity organizations, Farm Bureau is probably the most conservative of them. And so, you know, as one president of Farm Bureau, a State Farm Bureau, told me when I was writing the book, you had, you know, they had a conference call. They had a policy and they had an understanding and they had had an effort to move in a particular way on climate change for quite some time. But what it came down to is you have 45 state presidents on a phone call. Maybe one or two had voted for Obama and they decided to be very much against his initiatives on climate change. And that really was the move forward for them. So, and they have pretty much been in the same corner on that discussion really ever since. So
do you think since then there's been any kind of an evolution? Or I guess I'm wondering whether it's even, well, one, we don't have Obama in the White House anymore. Two, the sort of elephant in the room has become more and more apparent, I think, even on farms with extreme weather and the cost that farmers have got to be feeling, certainly. And then the third thing is what you wrote about very recently, the North American, I just learned about, the North American mm-hmm. Climate Smart Alliance, which was actually hosted in Washington, D.C. by the American Farm Bureau Federation. So, yeah, I wonder if you could comment on that.
Yeah, that came about really just a couple of weeks ago. So part of while the U.S. has decided, or at least President Trump has decided, that the U.S. isn't going to play ball on the Paris Accord, the U.N. has moved forward with a big effort. The United Nations has moved forward with a big effort to look at agriculture and climate change and, deal with adaptive measures in different forms. So the UN started this really at the end of 2015. But of course, everything with a big international body like that takes time to get off the ground. So the agricultural groups in the US have kind of figured out we better get with the program and make sure we're at the table, or what's going to happen is we're going to get our lunch eaten in international trade down the line by the Europeans and other countries. So kind of defense mechanism, nothing really forces you to change your mind, like a pocketbook situation. Agricultural groups, the commodity organizations, have figured out that they really do need to have a voice and play a part, have a North American plan and strategy for dealing with climate change in agriculture, to go to these UN talks with, and show that there is leadership in the United States in this issue, because they don't, primarily because they don't want the Europeans to dictate the policy. They want to have a voice and ensure that biotechnology is a part of it, for one thing. That's a big big issue, if between the battles and the perceptions between how Europeans view biotechnology and how Americans view biotechnology. So the this is kind of a, to use the phrase, come to Jesus moment, so to speak, for American agricultural groups, to say we can't ignore this issue anymore for a variety of reasons. And a lot of their members have been really pushing them to do this, but it does become a trade issue down the line if the United States continues to take a really negative, we're not going to be engaged in this stance, and the Europeans, Japanese, South Americans, Asia, other Asian countries like China, all get together and decide that, you know, we're going to really measure metrics of how you sequester carbon, how you manage fertilizer, how you manage water and agriculture, and that's going to help drive some of our buying decisions. And if U.S. agriculture doesn't have a metric, doesn't have a policy, doesn't have a strategy, then we risk losing losing some exports. We risk losing value. We risk losing money. So it's a little bit of self-preservation has driven the groups back to the table on this, so to speak.
So, and is the farm? Do you think the American Farm Bureau Federation is part of that movement? Are they? Is that a real sort of movement on their part?
Well, you know, I was at their annual meeting and they didn't really discuss it much at all. They discussed anything really related to climate change at the meeting. So we'll have to see. They are, the organization's membership is very supportive of the president. And that showed greatly at their annual meeting, which was really a packed house when President Trump came to speak. So he didn't really touch upon any of those kind of issues, climate related at all as well. So, but another aspect I think that Farm Bureau is going to have to come around with a little bit is the fact that Farm Bureau is also an insurance company. And in the grand scheme of things, Farm Bureau, the vast majority of their members, primarily their members because of they buy insurance through Farm Bureau. I mean, the largest Farm Bureau membership in the country statewide is in Tennessee. It's not because Tennessee has more farmers than anybody else. It's because they do a great job. They're obviously selling insurance for automobiles, everything else. But the property and casualty damages that are coming in the South, where Farm Bureau's membership is more dominant, you know, they're the ones, their insurance is the ones taking the hits on the flooding that happens from all of these hurricanes, et cetera. So it does begin to really gouge into their bottom line, purely because from an insurance issue, you know, they're paying out a lot more money because of natural disasters. And that, again, will come around to change some of the mindset of their leadership when the insurance guys are feeling the pinch because of loss ratios from disasters. So that eventually they're going to come around on this a little bit more. But they're the kind of the delegates, the guys who end up going to their meetings, are largely a little more conservative and slower to change.
So are there another thing I found very interesting in your book was you also described early on, I think, kind of the parallel growth of bold Nebraska and the sort of collaboration, I guess, that happened in Nebraska between those who would traditionally would be not so conservative, fighting against a pipeline, and those that, you know, again, maybe those that would tend to be members of the Farm Bureau or more conservative farmers. Do you think, so I wonder if you could comment on that, and I wonder if you could comment on whether you see any of that happening now in any kind of case, or if you think it's possible. And not only with the Farm Bureau, but just kind of with farmers in general.
Well, all of these pipeline kind of projects and natural gas exploration, et cetera, all have kind of similar themes. I focused on Nebraska simply because our offices are based in Omaha, and I got to really follow. It was only a few hour drives to really go visit and engage in some of the farmers who were involved in that. But you see the same kind of themes everywhere. If you've read the book, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, you see the same kind of challenges from the rancher in that book about natural gas and oil mining in Montana. You have the people who, the ranchers who don't want to have a pipeline come across their land, want to be have see their land mined nearby, etc. And you have the others who see the financial aspects and believe that this would be a good money-making situation for them. And you can very much have that same kind of situation in Nebraska. A little different dynamic, I think, adds to it in Nebraska. If you ever pull up a map of the Ogallala Aquifer, the Ogallala Aquifer, whoever drew the map in Nebraska, had no concept of what they had done because, you know, you basically, Nebraska overlays really a giant lake of water, unlike, you know, really any other state. The aquifer stretches pretty much the full length of Nebraska. And if you look at the Ogallala further south of the, some people call it the High Plains Aquifer, it's a lot less in Kansas and further south. So Nebraska has more irrigation farming than any place else. And everybody is really taught from a very early age in the state about the value and the importance of that aquifer to the state. So it's drinking water for animals. It's drinking water for humans. It's irrigation for crops. Nebraska corn production wouldn't be anywhere near it actually is because if the irrigation were to go away. So that importance of protecting the aquifer from oil spills also plays into it as well there. But it did really motivate, the Keystone XL did really motivate some really rural interest to come together with environmental interest in the state that you probably hadn't seen in any way before. But some of the farmers involved in the Keystone XL were also guys who sold their grain to biofuel companies, to ethanol companies. And they didn't understand, and they make the case, why would a state that its economy is based on agriculture and is producing so many billions of gallons of biofuels, be so supportive and willing of a pipeline that in the sense would undercut biofuel usage in some way or another, whether it's whether the petroleum is used in the U.S. or exported. So that's really kind of another kind of underlying tone there from some of the farmers as, well, look, you know, we grow corn that is used for ethanol. Why do we got to end up supporting a pipeline? And the battle continues in the state today. There's still, Keystone is still working to, TransCanada is still working to build that pipeline.
Interesting. So I have, that's very, very, one more question I have, and then I want to encourage people to ask questions. Clearly, mm-hmm. Chris is incredibly knowledgeable about just the dynamics of farmers and also rural communities, I think, which must be connected. But I wanted to ask you, what is the general sense among your readers about the value now of prioritizing soil health in terms of its ability to address the climate risk, you know, by increasing resiliency and protecting water, and also improving profitability, because I know maybe you could touch on the farm economy a little bit, and also sequestering carbon.
That's a lot right there. But the soil health movements and programs have been expanding in different ways. You have some private efforts such as Monsanto's relationship with the National Corn Growers and a few others to really create pilot test farms around the Midwest and measure the metrics and the benefits of soil health. One of the problems that we have with no-till systems and cover crop systems is that we really don't have any great data on highlighting overall benefits of profitability in those systems versus other systems, versus farmers that till heavily, use a lot more perhaps fertilizer and don't grow anything in the off season on their farms. So that's part of the drive in some of these programs. There's a group called the Soil Health Institute that was formed by a grant by the Noble Foundation out of Oklahoma to really once again delve into the science of soils and the system that might work best, say in Ohio, might not be the same kind of system that works best in Western Kansas, but looking at what are the production practices that are the most beneficial. You also just have guys who are, outside of the aspects of climate or whatever, really look at it more as a soil erosion issue. And they are obsessive about not losing any soil off their fields. And they realize that maybe that's become a little more challenging as the weather has become volatile over time as well. But we're still missing good metrics to be able to say that farming no-till, planting a multi-crop species of cover crops in the off-season is more economically beneficial for farmers than other practices. Another wild card that kind of comes into this problem or this issue as well is the fact that in Iowa, for instance, where I live, at least half, if not more, of the land that is farmed is rented. and a lot of it is rented on year-to-year basis. Absentee landowners who have either moved to the city or moved to the Southwest to stay warm in the winter, et cetera. They mostly are the ones that, dad ran the farm. He passed away 30 years ago. The kids decided to keep it, but they end up renting it every year to somebody. And a lot of these cases, the rental agreements have been long term, but in some others, landlords will look every year to year to try to get a better deal. So that translates negatively in a situation when you have a farmer who's actually operating the land, trying to implement these conservation practices. And yet, you don't know if you're going to be able to farm that land next year or the year after. Maybe you're on a 3-year lease agreement or whatever. You've got people who actually, and some of these farmers actually understand that the guy next door has been doing no-till for a few years, so that land has gotten more rich in carbon. So when the opportunity comes up to rent, they're looking to go ahead and take that land away from the other guy because they know that land has actually got a little more stored carbon in it and a little more stored nutrients, and they'll see the opportunity to rip that up and farm it themselves. So the challenges of so much land being rented also plays into this. Somewhat. It is the one area, though, in which USDA and members of Congress are able to dance around the topic of climate change by embracing the issue of soil health. And the aspects of soil health, play into so many different ways. Our biggest issue environmentally in Iowa is water quality. Outside of long-term issues with climate change and everything else, just pure water quality from nitrogen and phosphorus runoff. And obviously, if you have no-till practices in there, you are able to increase water holding capacity within the soil. Your drainage is not so much. There are some great videos out there from NRCS and others showing how, a field that is tilled and has got any kind of grade to it whatsoever, when that water hits it, it just rushes right off. And it's taking soil and it's taking nutrients, everything with it, right along with it. And then you show a field that has a nice cover crop growing on it, and that water is going to absorb and soak in like a sponge, and far less likely that you're going to see the water just basically run right into the local stream, into the river, and so on. So that's kind of, I think, one of the components that also gets a lot lost in some of the debate about ag and climate change is the practices that sequester carbon in the soil have so many other benefits to them, water quality being among the biggest. So, and I probably rambled on a little too much there, but I hope that answered your question.
Oh, yeah, thank you. I think, so that's, to me, it sounds like really positive, a positive perspective. And I think what I heard you say is that's one way, used the phrase dance around. I mean, so that's one way all of us as people that would like to address climate change and also include our agriculture in the discussion, we can talk about that. And that that should be possible. So the last question, and I hope that other people will, feel comfortable to unmute and raise questions, is so that's one positive thing. And this one, it's a hard question. I just thought I'd ask you, though, because you have been around for so long and in this area. So recognizing how tough the Farm Bureau is, and we'll continue to try to build relationships with them. And we have started building relationships with a commodity, with the Corn Growers Association and with the rice growers. But what kind of advice or recommendations might you give to us or those of us that would like to bridge in a mutually respectful, knowledgeable way that sort of divide to get to sort of create the space where agriculture, both big agriculture and small agriculture, can be at the table to help solve climate change? What would you recommend?
I have no great solution there, unfortunately. It is an evolving issue and topic for a lot of farmers in different ways. I'm going to no-till on the plains next week. This time, that's an event down in southern Kansas this year. Alan Savory will be one of the keynote speakers there. And so a lot of people in agriculture, their methods or ideas don't always completely fully jibe with what the climate experts see or believe is the case or should happen. And, you know, Savory is a big advocate for putting more livestock back on the ground. Some of the reasons for doing that basically is the nutrient value that comes basically from livestock manure and the grazing that is done on from cattle and other livestock in the fields. But his TED talk got really picked on basically by some climate scientists as not being as validated. So here you have the idea of bringing more livestock back into the into farm operation, and diversifying the operation in that way. Relying more on the natural fertilizer that comes from the animals. And so if the climate scientists say that is bad, a bad strategy, then the farmers and others basically here will keep what we're doing. So you have the idea of basically livestock, and of course livestock have their methane emissions as well, versus fertilizer. And the nitrous oxide emissions that come from that. And, you know, nitrous oxide emissions are like 294 times more potent than carbon. And then they also have tremendous water quality problems that comes from the tillage as well. So I think a lot of times farmers see damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of mindset with some people on these topics. But more and more farmers are looking at different solutions to reduce their own machinery costs, reduce their own fuel costs, and also deal with the extreme events. Most everybody is able to handle a 1-inch rain, but when it's a 3, 4, 5, 6-inch rain, and you're not able to get in your field for quite a while because your field is completely tilled and it's pure mud, and you look over and you see that the guy who had a cover crop and had a lot of residue left on his field is able to get in there earlier, these kind of things start to have a effect. But I think most organizations that are really wanting to be in this arena and dealing with farmers and agriculture need to look at the guys who are already out there doing a lot of these practices and are speakers. You know, I mean, these are guys like Dave Brandt in Ohio, who is asked to speak all over the place. Gabe Brown up in North Dakota. Some of these guys, their views on climate themselves are not fully, you know, shaped in different ways, but their views on farm practices and the strategies are, you know, and they're not doing it maybe necessarily because they're looking at the whole globe agriculturally. They're looking at it because this is the way that they believe they can farm and be better stewards locally, or break away some sense from also corporate agriculture in different ways. If you can, you know, you can become, you know, as some people up in Burley County, North Dakota, where Gabe Brown is, and some of my friends call that the Jerusalem of cover crops in the United States. Those guys up there are, you know, looking for something like no-till nor organic as a nirvana. You know, it might be an impossible strategy, but it's something that they're trying to achieve. You know.
One final question I have: what does DTN stand for?
Well, it used to be back in the 80s when DTN started, it was Data Transmission Network. And the whole basis of how it started was that they set up a satellite system so that farmers could get grain prices. This was the real driving force behind it back in the 80s. You get grain prices at your farm through a satellite terminal. Data Transmission Network, and basically so you could see that every grain elevator within a 50 or 150 mile radius of you, what they were offering for corn, soybeans, wheat, or whatever. So over time, like AARP, we just kind of became DTN, and then the company bought Progressive Farmer Magazine, which is one of the oldest farm magazines in the country, back around 2007. But most everybody in the cattle and the farm business still knows who DTN is, just because we're grain elevators and such. So,
good. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. And I think we do have to sign off. I have a feeling you'll be hearing from a lot of us again. Thank you so much.
I'm going to unmute everyone. You can all say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Good luck. Bye.
Be better.